This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. Today, we will be speaking live with Captain Paul Watson somewhere near Antarctica in the Southern Sea on the deck of the ship Steve Irwin. He is defying Japanese whalers whom he discovered through sailing and nautical intelligence. We'll also be taking a look at U.S. interests in Nigerian oil. That along with our exclusive renditions of the most recent and relevant WikiLeaks State Department cables. All of that coming up on today's 5 O'Clock Shadow following a summary of world news from INN, the International News Net. Stay tuned.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
Anti-whalers Saturday clashed with Japanese harpoonists in the Southern Ocean. Activists chased the whalers through ice packs and hurled stink bombs at them. The harpoonists retaliated with water cannon. Lockie McLean, captain of the Sea Shepherds Conservation Society's vessel, said, "It was deadly because of the ice and the hostility of the whalers, and beautiful because while clashing with us, these three killer ships were not killing whales."
New WikiLeaks documents Monday show U.S. diplomats acted as salespeople for U.S. aircraft giant Boeing. The cables describe state visits used as bargaining chips and a number of world leaders making big purchases based partly on how much Boeing and its competitor Airbus were willing to dress up private planes. In 2006, Israel Hernandez, a senior Commerce Department official, hand-delivered a letter from George Bush to Saudi Arabian King Abdullah, urging the king to buy up to 43 Boeing jets for Saudi Arabian Airlines and 13 jets for the Saudi Royal Fleet. The king agreed to buy the planes on condition his personal plane would be outfitted with, quote, all the technology that his friend President Bush had on Air Force One. Robert Hormats, Undersecretary for Economic Affairs at the State Department, said, quote, "That is the reality of the 21st century. Governments are playing a greater role in supporting their companies."
For more details on these stories, visit innworldreport.net.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating from New York station WBAI. My name is Robert Knight, and we have the great honor of speaking live with the captain of the Steve Irwin. That is a ship of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Captain Paul Watson, welcome aboard. What are your coordinates and what is your condition?
Oh, we're about 1,500 miles southeast of New Zealand right now, about a couple hundred miles off the coast of Antarctica, and presently we're chasing the Japanese whaling fleet westward. We've chased them 750 miles since the day we found them on December 31st, and I'm happy to report that they haven't killed a single whale this season.
The Sea Shepherd Society has long been a very courageous interventionist against the harpooning. Why are you doing that?
Well, we're not a protest organization. We're an anti-poaching organization, and the Japanese are down here in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary poaching whales. You don't kill whales in a whale sanctuary, and they're targeting endangered and protected whales in violation of a global moratorium on whaling, and they're in contempt of the Australian Federal Court for taking whales in the Australian Antarctic Territory. Since governments aren't doing anything about it, we've taken it upon ourselves to harass them and speak the language they understand, which is an economic one. We've cost them their profits for 5 years. Last year, we saved more whales than they killed, and this year, we're hoping to have a zero-kill quota. We'll just keep on their back and make sure they don't kill any whales at all. And this is costing them hundreds of millions of dollars. They're already $200 million in debt to the Japanese government in subsidies. So we're breaking them economically, and that's the objective.
When it's winter in North America, I presume it's springtime there. Is that a basis for the seasonality for the Japanese whale hunt to be taking place in such southern latitudes now?
Yes, the whaling season is in the Antarctic summer. Of course, that's relatively speaking. It's 5 below 0 here right now with snowstorms, but it is the summertime, and it's impossible to do any of these kind of operations in the wintertime down here. But the Japanese, their season ends at the end of March. So we'll be here every day until the end of March on their tail, chasing them, blocking them, preventing them from killing whales.
What ships have you encountered and what have the interactions been? Have there been any collisions, any risks, any threats, any kinds of physical interactions? What has happened so far?
We discovered the fleet on New Year's Eve. They arrived late, and we arrived just as they arrived, so they hadn't had a chance to kill any whales. The Nishan Maru began to run. We're chasing it. They tried to block our efforts to go after it, but that resulted in confrontations with our ships and the harpoon vessels and some very heavy ice, and that resulted in water cannons being fired by them and our retaliation with our stink bombs. And anyway, we got by them. We're chasing them, and so right now the Nishan Maru is ahead of us. We're following, and the harpoon vessels are behind us, and so far we've chased them 750 miles.
Are you sailing solo? Do you have a support fleet? What other deployments is Sea Shepherd involved in?
Sea Shepherd has three vessels down here, the Bob Barker, the Steve Irwin, and our fast pursuit vessel, the Gojira, which is ahead of us. And so there's three vessels, and how we found the Japanese fleet was I put them at three different latitudes, 60, 62, and 64, and just headed eastward, and we ran into them at the easternmost boundary of their hunting area. They went as far away as they possibly could to avoid us, but it was of no use. We figured that's what they would do. We went right for them when we found them.
Captain Watson, this is more intriguing than run silent, run deep. Can you take a little bit more time to explain your logic and, as I described it, nautical intelligence in inferring the position of the Japanese whalers?
Every year we come down here stronger. The Japanese are coming down weaker. This year they were 3 weeks late coming down. And what I did was I put one vessel in Wellington, New Zealand, another one in Hobart, and one right smack in the middle of the Tasman Sea. So that blocked them from coming through the Tasman Sea, which was the shortest path to the Southern Ocean. So then we got a report from the Solomon Islands. They were heading on a course southeast, which I figured that they would be going as far away as they possibly could from us, which is the easternmost boundary of their hunting area. So we went to that area by going along the lines of latitude. And on December 31st, we ran smack right into them just as they arrived.
You talk about stink bombs. What is their purpose?
We harass them by keeping them, if they try to turn water cannons on us, we retaliate with these stink bombs. Two substances that we use, one's rotten butter, and the other one is a thing called pseudocorps, which is a sort of a artificial human remains that's used to train police dogs. But they're both repulsive smells, and that keeps them off the deck and keeps them busy and keeps them from working.
Shades of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, I guess we call the Pirates of the Antarctic.
Yeah, but it's not always such fun and games, nor is it ever safe, is it? I understand you've lost a ship over the course of time.
Last year, the vessel Adi Gil was cut in half by a Japanese whaler and sunk, and six of our people were almost killed. But over the years, we've not had anybody injured. We've not injured anybody. It is dangerous. There's no doubt about it. The weather, the ice conditions are dangerous. The Japanese whalers are hostile. And we're down here trying to do everything we can, making sure we don't injure any of them, but they're trying to kill us, so it's a little one-sided. But so far, we've handled this very responsibly. Nobody's been injured, and we've cut their kill quotas in half, and this year I'm hoping to cut it by 100%.
We're speaking with Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He is commanding the ship, the Steve Irwin, in the Southern Sea off New Zealand near the Antarctic South Pole of the planet Earth. And Paul, you make a very clear distinction that you're not protesting, you're intervening against poaching. For those who are unfamiliar with the world protocols on whaling and the preservation of species and such, can you give a legal or a broader perspective of what regulations and issues are being tested here?
The commercial whaling activities were barred by the International Whaling Commission in 1986. Japan responded by saying, well, this isn't commercial, this is scientific research whaling, which nobody's buying. They haven't issued a single peer-reviewed international scientific paper in 23 years. But it's a commercial activity. But aside from that, this is the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary declared in 1994, and you don't kill whales in a whale sanctuary. So we're protecting the integrity of the sanctuary and upholding the ban on commercial whaling. They're also refueling their vessels south of 60 degrees, which is a violation of the Antarctic Treaty. They're throwing offal or waste from the dead whales into the Antarctic Sea south of 60, a violation of the Antarctic Treaty. They're taking whales in the Australian Antarctic Territory, which they're in contempt of the Australian Federal Court for doing so. So they're an illegal operation. They constantly are calling us pirates and eco-terrorists and everything, but we haven't been charged or even disciplined by the Netherlands or the U.S. or any other country for what we're doing, because we're not breaking any laws, we're not hurting anybody, we're simply upholding international conservation law and doing so in accordance with the United Nations World Charter for Nature, which allows non-government organizations to intervene to uphold conservation laws.
Shades of King and Gandhi, you're conducting nautical disobedience, as it were.
No, we're simply upholding international conservation law.
Okay, it is, you know, for the law.
We're an anti-poaching organization, really. So, you know, we're not down here to hang banners and take pictures. We're down here to stop their illegal activities.
Captain Watson, as you have become aware within the past 24 hours, your organization was the subject of discussion at high-level diplomatic exchanges between the United States and Japan. I'd like for you to listen to 40 seconds of a rendition of a State Department cable released overnight by WikiLeaks.
Machida said there are factors outside the current future of the IWC negotiations that influence Japan's negotiating position. The violent protests by the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society SSCS could limit the GOJ's flexibility in the negotiations. He said the Netherlands should have primary responsibility for taking action against the SSCS, but he appreciates the USG initiative to address the group's tax-exempt status. He said action on the SSCS would be a major element for Japan in the success of the overall negotiations. Regarding the SSCS, she said she believes the USG can demonstrate the group does not deserve tax-exempt status based on their aggressive and harmful actions.
There you are. The United States Department of State suggesting that your actions are harmful, illegal, and subject to a review or revocation of your tax-exempt status. Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, I'd like your response to that disclosure.
I believe that conversation took place in November in 2009, but we haven't heard anything from the U.S. government in response to it. I also believe that Monica Medina, the IWC commissioner, may have committed an impeachable offense by saying that she can take a tax status away from an American NGO at the bequest of a foreign power for political reasons. We haven't committed any law. We haven't broken any laws. We haven't injured anybody. So there is simply absolutely no reason for her to say that she has the authority to do that. So we'll be certainly looking into that. What we were quite gratified about the WikiLeaks report was that it did say that we were responsible for cutting the Japanese kill quotas, and we were quite happy about that.
Have you endured any other behavior, surveillances, interferences, obstructions that you think might be consistent with the fishing industry or other agencies to prevent your work of impeding the whaling?
No, like I said, we haven't done anything wrong. We fly the flag of the Netherlands. The Netherlands has not reprimanded us for our activities. We haven't been approached by anybody from the U.S. government, as I said. And we've been a tax-exempt charitable organization in the United States since 1981. We haven't done anything different, so there's no reason for any action to be taken against us. Japan, of course, is extremely angry at us. We've cost some hundreds of millions of dollars. The Japanese whaling industry is $200 million in debt and subsidy loans to the Japanese government. Last year, we saved 528 whales. They killed 506, so we saved more than they killed. And this year, we've got them down to they haven't killed a single one. So they're very upset and understand. They're a very powerful economic power, so we expect to see this kind of bullying at that level.
The Sea Shepherd Society is globally supported. Can you take a moment for our listeners so they can know what you do and how to interact?
Yes, our organization right now, we have three ships down the Southern Ocean with 88 crew members, 22 different countries. We're registered in dozens of countries around the world, and we're addressing things like shark finning in the Galapagos and in Costa Rica, the hunting of seals in South Africa, the killing of dolphins in Japan, illegal whaling in the North Pacific, illegal longlining. We're probably the leading organization in the Galapagos right now, working in partnership with the Ecuadorian Federal Police and the Galapagos Park Rangers to stop poaching there. So we're operating internationally and addressing all of those illegal acts of exploitation.
That's quite a wide-ranging seafaring set of operations or initiatives. You ever make it to the Gulf of Mexico?
In fact, we've had a team in the Gulf of Mexico since May under the leadership of Dr. Bonnie Schumacher, and that's been very frustrating. Because we've been trying to do what we can there, but we've been blocked by BP and by the U.S. government, which makes it pretty much illegal to rescue an animal that's covered in oil. We have been uncovering a lot of scandals and getting evidence of things which the government and BP don't want us to see, of course. So we still have a team there. It's an ongoing campaign in the Gulf, but I think there's a lot that's going on in the Gulf that is being kept from the public.
Captain Paul Watson, it is truly an honor to speak with you live today on 5 o'clock Shadow in the midst of your anti-poaching activity. And just for the sake of those who do study and travel the Earth, what are your geographical coordinates at this time?
Right now, we're down here at 177 degrees west and, let me see, 63 degrees south, really down in the Southern Ocean. I can give those coordinates because the Japanese ships are right with us, so we're not giving away anything they don't know.
Well, thank you. You have the last word for the world in your live expedition against poaching. What is your last word for us, Paul?
Well, if we don't protect the fish in the ocean and the whales in the sea, we're not going to be able to protect the oceans. And the truth of it is if the oceans die, we die. We need a healthy ocean to survive. And that's what really this is all about, our self-preservation.
It's an honor. We'll stay in touch, stay safe, and continue to serve the Earth, sir.
Thank you very much.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York. My name is Robert Knight. We'll have more after this.
Every day these days, and the world puts on a new face. Certain things rearrange, and the world seems like a new place. Secretly, I've been trailing you.
Representative to the International Whaling Commission IWC Monica Medina met with senior officials from the Fisheries Agency of Japan FAJ. He defended Japan's proposal to base future reductions in numbers on current catch quotas rather than the actual number of whales taken in past years. Ms. Medina said the USG is looking for creative solutions to the remaining issue. Regarding the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society SSCS, she said she believes the USG can demonstrate the group does not deserve tax-exempt status based on their aggressive and harmful actions.
You're listening to 5 O'Clock Shadow on Pacifica Radio. This a cetaceous mix featuring Grace Jones and produced by our very own Caitlin Press. My name is Robert Knight. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We have this bulletin just in from the Sea Shepherd Society, headlined WikiLeaks reveals Sea Shepherd is a serious concern to Japan's illegal whaling operations. It reads as follows. WikiLeaks has revealed that the Japanese government views Sea Shepherd Conservation Society as a very serious threat to their illegal whaling activities. In a classified U.S. Department of State document released by WikiLeaks to El País newspaper in Spain, the Japanese Deputy General Director for the Japanese Fisheries Agency, Mr. Yamashita, pointed out that, quote, the harassment of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society had kept the Japanese whaling fleet from reaching its quotas these last few years, end quote. There it is. For all the critics who have been saying the anti-whaling campaigns have not been effective, Sea Shepherd holds the same position as the Japanese Fisheries Agency, that the campaigns have been very effective. So effective, in fact, that Sea Shepherd has been discussed in high-level talks by Japanese government representatives with the United States Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. That just in from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society at seashepherd.org. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, and we have, in fact, done one of our exclusive broadcast versions of the audio rendition of those oh-so-informative State Department cables. Here now, we actually hear the relevant part of the November 9th, 2009 State Department cable from Tokyo in relation to the Sea Shepherd Society.
Subject: Japan receptive to further engagement on whaling. Date: November 9, 2009 66. Origin: Embassy, Tokyo. Paragraph 1. Summary. U.S. Representative to the International Whaling Commission IWC Monica Medina met with senior officials from the Fisheries Agency of Japan FAJ November 4 to discuss progress in negotiations under the future of the IWC process. The FAJ Director General described the results of recent talks in Santiago as a major step forward and said political-level consultations on whaling are necessary following the recent change in administration in Japan. He defended Japan's proposal to base future reductions in numbers on current catch quotas rather than the actual number of whales taken in past years. He added that Australia's proposal to phase out research whaling is a non-starter for Japan. He said a successful outcome in the vote on Greenland's proposal to take humpback whales and action by the U.S. and others on Japan's complaints against the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society would positively influence Japan's negotiating position in the future of the IWC process. Ms. Medina said the USG is looking for creative solutions to the remaining issues facing the IWC and positive mention at the upcoming U.S.-Japan summit of both sides' commitment to finding a solution on whaling would be a good signal. End summary. Paragraph 6. Machida said there are factors outside the current future of the IWC negotiations that influence Japan's negotiating position. The violent protests by the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society SSCS could limit the GOJ's flexibility in the negotiations. He said the Netherlands should have primary responsibility for taking action against the SSCS, but he appreciates the USG initiative to address the group's tax-exempt status. He said action on the SSCS would be a major element for Japan in the success of the overall negotiations. Regarding the SSCS, she said she believes the USG can demonstrate the group does not deserve tax-exempt status based on their aggressive and harmful actions.
That from a United States Embassy cable from the Embassy in Tokyo, a State Department cable, indicating collaboration with Japan for invidious treatment of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which is currently engaged in an anti-poaching operation in the Southern Sea. We just finished speaking live with the captain of the Stephen Irwin ship, Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society. In a related note, we have this just in from the Associated Press. Japan agency warned not to accept whale meat gifts. From Tokyo, the Japanese Fisheries Agency has warned its officials against accepting whale meat as gifts from whalers. Just weeks after Japan's whaling expedition left for the Antarctic Ocean on its annual hunts, the agency recommended five officials for accepting whale meat from a fisheries company that operates the government-funded whaling program from 1999 to 2008, agency official Koji Hamada said. The whale meat gifts total some 25 kilograms, or 55 pounds, worth more than 270,000 yen, that's $3,200 United States, at market value. The officials were suspected of violating public servants' ethical standards. They acknowledged accepting the gifts after returning from each whaling expedition they accompanied separately as a supervisor. Earlier this month, Japanese whalers left for the Antarctic Ocean for their annual hunts, and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society boats have also left New Zealand in pursuit. Article goes on to conclude that Japan hunts whales under the research exemption to a 1986 worldwide ban on commercial hunts. Critics say there is no reason to kill the animals, and the research program amounts to commercial whaling in disguise, because surplus meat from the sea hunt is sold domestically. That from the Associated Press in relation to the current sea hunt, the cetaceous slaughter that is attempting to be underway in the South Sea, unless the intervention of the Sea Shepherd Society continues to be successful and safe. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. We'll be back with more after this.
Kill everything, including you and me. your expensive clothes. I think somebody might just shut something.
Jim Capaldi, We'll Meet Again, here on 5 O'Clock Shadow. You're tuned to WBAI New York and or the Pacifica Radio Network and or WBAI.org, streaming live. We welcome your contact and content here at 5 O'Clock Shadow with an email to theshadow, T-H-E-S-H-A-D-O-W at WBAI.org, or drop us a letter at WBAI 120 Wall Street, New York, 10005. We turn our sights now to another issue of energy and water, and that is the U.S. involvement in Nigeria, the oil companies' involvement, Chevron, Shell, and others that are concordant with the suppression and murders of many protesters and of the local people who were caught in the crosshairs of ambition of the oil companies. There was, on February 23rd, 2010, a cable sent from the United States Embassy in Lagos, one of the more recent WikiLeaks, in which Assistant Secretary Carson of the U.S. mission to, or the U.S. Delegation to Nigeria, met with members of the International Oil Company. Here are some of those who are in attendance: Shell Senior Vice President Ann Pickard and Ian Craig, Shell Vice President Peter Robinson, Chevron Managing Director Andrew Fawthorpe, Chevron Public Affairs Manager Femi Odumombo, ExxonMobil Managing Director Mark Ward, Hercules Manager Coleman McDonough, Schlumberger Manager Supply Chain Service Dimi Andusi, American Business Council President Dick Kramer, Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary, the Economic Officer, Maritime Affairs Officer, and Consul General of Lagos. Here are the most revealing parts of that United States Embassy cable from Lagos about Chevron, Shell, and all of the other oil companies taking advantage of Nigerian resources.
Summary. Paragraph 1. Assistant Secretary R. Persekan Carson met with members of the International Oil Company's IOCs on February 7. The R. Persekan stressed the fact that Nigeria is the most important country in Africa for the United States. The IOC members noted that the R. Persekan spoke mainly of issues in northern Nigeria and did not dwell on southern issues. The petroleum industry bill is discouraging future investment mostly in deep water fields where most of the remaining oil in Nigeria lies. If Nigeria raised the price of gas to two-thirds of the world price, the IOC would be at each other's throats trying to cut the price by a penny or two. Nigeria has the possibility of becoming the next Pakistan within 25 years. R. Persekan Carson allayed the IOC's concerns of the United States' relationship with China. End summary. Nigeria, most important country in Africa. Paragraph 3. Fawthorpe asked the R. Persekan whether he was in Nigeria to deliver a message or was it more of a fact-finding trip. R. Persekan Carson stated that he was in Nigeria for both reasons, in that he wanted to listen and engage with Nigeria. Nigeria is the most important country in Africa for the United States due to the size of its population, presence of hydrocarbons, peacekeeping role in ECOWAS, especially in Sierra Leone and Liberia, its seat on the United Nations Security Council, along with the strength and size of its financial markets. The R. Persekan continued, Nigeria has enormous potential and is the seventh largest Muslim country in the world with an Islamic population that will eclipse Egypt by 2015, according to R. Persekan Carson. Having no United States presence in northern Nigeria is akin to having no presence in Egypt and is why the United States is considering opening a consulate in Kano. Paragraph 4. See, the United States is concerned about the power vacuum in Nigeria and the state of health of President Yar'Adua, per R. Persekan Carson. The president is very ill, and Nigerians are under illusions regarding the state of their president. Nigeria cannot afford to implode or run aground. 30 years of military government was not good. The United States expects a stable, legal, democratic, constitutionally based government with no military involvement, full stop R per second Carson stated. It is important for the GON to do a better job this time around in regards to elections. Only 10% of Nigerians saw a ballot ticket in the 2007 elections.
And that is an excerpt from a State Department cable dated February 23, 2010, about U.S. oil interests in Nigeria. That is a subject that has also been taken up by our broadcast partners, the National Radio Project. And to give a bit more depth and perspective to the machinations of the United States government in Nigeria, we give this documentary background to what is really happening with the oil and the people in Nigeria. It is called Standing Up to Big Oil.
Chevron has been in Nigeria for decades, working closely with the Nigerian government to exploit oil resources and laying waste to the Niger Delta. Their exploration, extraction, and refining of petroleum have polluted drinking water and ruined farmlands and fisheries. One of the Niger Delta communities severely affected is the Alaje tribe. Munde Omoshaya, a member of the Alaje, says his people have faced dire conditions.
After the activities of the oil company, you have to journey 20, 15 kilometers or more to have your fresh water. To some people, it's almost the whole day journey, 12 hours or more. We have a heavy rainfall during some months. But because the gas flaring in the area, we even drink acid drain. It is dangerous because most of the time we have a kind of rain that is as black colored. So till today, no potable drinking water in the environment.
Activist Suwanu Bere grew up as an Ogoni villager in the Niger Delta. He says the Ogoni experienced the same conditions, the same struggles as the Ilaje.
When Shell and Chevron come into the land, start drain oil, having toxins, pollution, everything we plant, it did not grow up or yield any fruit for us. I noticed this in 1980, and the pollution killed a lot of fish, oil bursting at several times and flow on the ground, flow on the water, flow and everything. Our yams, our fruit, our coconut tree get dying. You see them dying off because of a lot of toxins and gas flowing around. And people were getting sick. Some people have asthma, diabetes, cancer, all sort of sickness. And mostly we don't have hospital that we use to cure ourselves. So my people are living with a lot of things, poverty, no food.
The Ilaje, the Ogoni, and other communities have struggled to bring Chevron to a bargaining table. They've asked for environmental cleanup, drinkable water, jobs, infrastructure, and basic education from the oil giant. But they've received no cooperation, says Omoshaya.
When I was representing the community, Chevron will make promises upon promises, like provision of potable water, as a social responsibility from a company who is benefiting huge amount of money from the business. They have the moral and social responsibility of, let's do this thing for these people to make life better for them. So they promise they will give us water, potable water. Throughout my tenure of 2 years in office, they did not. They promise they will do other things that will help alleviate the situation people experience. They did not.
In the 1990s, activist Ken Sarawiwa's movement for the rights of the Ogoni people in the Niger Delta, or MOSAP, took root among other villages and tribes. When the Nigerian government announced it would build a pipeline from Ogoniland to northern Nigeria, over 500,000 Nigerians turned out for a peaceful protest. Suwanu Bere was one of those protesters.
That's where the president organized his military to come and kill and destroy Ogoniland. And they start killing, burning houses, raping, torturing people, arresting people, people who were thrown inside the well, the little baby, mothers with pregnancy, they dump them into the well. The one they shot or the one they capture, they throw them into the well. And I was arrested, taken to their detention camp, and I was badly tortured. I was at the point of death.
In 1998, inspired by the growing grassroots activism in the Niger Delta, the Ilaje tribe organized a nonviolent takeover of a Chevron oil drilling platform. While the Ilaje negotiated in good faith, the Nigerian mobile police, well known as the Kill and Go, landed on the platform in Chevron Company helicopters. They detained, tortured, and killed many of the Ilaje there. Earth Rights International joined forces with other NGOs to help the Ilaje bring criminal charges against Chevron for the violence on the oil platform. In 2008, their landmark case, Bowoto versus Chevron, invoked the authority of the Alien Torts Statute, or ATS, which allowed plaintiffs to sue multinational corporations for human rights abuses. Law student and journalist Scott Gilmore kept a blog on the Bowoto versus Chevron trial. Gilmore saw the trial as a watershed event.
This is only the second Alien Tort Statute case against a multinational corporation to actually make it to a jury trial. So I wanted to document fairly faithfully what strategies were being used by the defense, by the plaintiffs. I think the defense had a twofold strategy. First, to deny that they had any intent to do harm when they engaged, when they hired Nigerian military personnel, the Kill and Go Mobile Police, Nigerian Navy, various armed forces, which are, you know, documents show are on Chevron's payroll. They were fed, they were housed, they were transported in company helicopters. Chevron made the claim that they did not, first of all, intend any harm. They didn't intend the armed forces to use lethal force. They didn't intend them to necessarily commit torture, illegal detention, any of the claims. And they also claimed that they had no knowledge that this would occur. Now, the plaintiffs countered that how could they not know that the Kill and Go Mobile Police, who have a notorious human rights record, who even in some of Chevron's internal memorandums and emails had described the Kill and Go as notoriously violent, as a threat even to Chevron personnel. How could they not know? I mean, with the well-documented history of human rights abuses in Nigeria.
The jury for the Bowoto versus Chevron trial absolved Chevron of any blame for what happened on the oil platform in 1998. But the plaintiffs have been working on an appeal, and Scott Gilmore sees progress.
There are other major cases pending. The settlements, such as in Dovi Unocal, these are very important settlements. And also the 9-year history of motions that have gone into Bowoto v. Chevron have done a lot to really cement the use of the Alien Tort Claims Act in case law.
The ATS, or Alien Torts Statute, has been the basis of most human rights litigation against multinational corporations in the past 40 years. But recently, a U.S. court held that corporations cannot be sued under the ATS. That landmark ruling may make it more difficult to use the ATS against international corporate crime. But many recent legal challenges to international corporate power have written new legal precedent. In Burma, Chevron settled a lawsuit and compensated villagers for human rights abuses. In Ecuador, an independent investigator ordered Chevron to pay $27 billion to the Amazonian people. And in Nigeria, a high court ordered Shell to pay $100 million to a Niger Delta community for a 1970 oil spill. And through the efforts of environmental NGOs like Earth Justice, Exxon has had to write hefty checks for the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound. Patty Goldman, Vice President of Litigation with Earth Justice, played a role in forcing Exxon to write those checks.
Exxon Valdez, the checks were finally written, but it was the last checks were 20 years later. It really was dragged out in the courts. The parts that were resolved quickly were the government penalties and the natural resource damages claims, because the government settled those. They wanted some certainty. They wanted to get the money to start the activities. Some people would say they lowballed it in order to get money more quickly. That's going to be a big concern down in the Gulf. That was being paid slowly over time, unfortunately, after a lot of the people who were harmed had died or lost their businesses.
Patty Goldman says that long-term damages will be the most difficult to determine and to recoup from the BP Gulf oil spill.
There are laws that were passed after Exxon Valdez that create absolute liability on BP's part to pay for containing, removing the oil, cleanup, and the harm to people, like for tourism, fishing, economic harm, direct economic harm. What's going to be really difficult is chronic illnesses, long-term illnesses or symptoms that come out of this, particularly because of this push to settle fast. And that's where the system is likely going to fall short. So we will be playing a role to try to get maximum access and public participation in that process and to make sure that BP and the governments don't settle too cheap, don't settle for the short term and certainty without really accounting for the long term harm that we fear we will see.
Earth Justice and other NGOs are using legal methods to try to mitigate that harm. They brought a lawsuit against the government for not enforcing regulations on blowout scenarios for offshore drilling. Earth Justice also filed Freedom of Information requests to get the secret ingredients of the dispersant Corexit, which BP poured into the Gulf by the millions of tons. They want to ensure that BP doesn't slip through the legal nets.
I think the first difficulty is that you are up against an entity with tremendous resources and an entity that is motivated by short-term economic goals. And that is really difficult when you have nonprofit lawyers who don't have those resources. We have a lot of heart, a lot of smarts. We work hard, but we don't have the whole law firms, you know, or a floor of a law firm to throw at a piece of litigation. So that is very tricky. And their goal then is to drag it out. And their lawyers are motivated to do that because their lawyers are paid by the hour. They're not paid to settle. They're paid to drag it out so they get more billable hours and they support their law firms. So the incentives are all against us. We want to be heard. We want to get information to prove our case. And we want decisions. We want them enforced. All of the incentives on their side are the opposite.
That's where public pressure and citizen action come into play, lending power and credibility to groups like Earth Justice. And the victims of big oil are using media to speak their truth to corporate power, calling for help from grassroots activists all over the world. One of those victims is Ola Oyimbo of the Ilaje, a Bowoto versus Chevron plaintiff whose husband was tortured to death by Nigeria's Kill and Go police.
My husband was one of the peaceful protesters on the Chevron oil platform back in May of 1998. My husband was detained and tortured during the protest. He was hanged. He was tortured so much that he got sick and it led to his death. Since my husband died, I've been suffering all alone, taking care of the kids he left behind. I want the American people to help us bring Chevron to justice, to help us curb Chevron's misconduct in Niger Delta. I want the American people to do whatever they can to bring justice on those who are committing injustice.
For Making Contact, I'm Lynn Feinerman.
And we give thanks also to producer Kyung Jin Lee. of Making Contact and the National Radio Project. Special thanks also to Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow with a live conversation from the deck of the Stephen Irwin, the interventionist ship that is thwarting whale poaching somewhere in the Southern Sea at 63 degrees south latitude between New Zealand and Antarctica. Thanks also to 5 O'Clock Shadow producer Caitlin Prest and studio engineer Michael G. Haskins. Give us an email at theshadow@wbai.org. For 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.